Why don't we get started? Because we're time constrained on the back end tonight. Because we want to end as near 7:15 as we can, because Vespers starts at 7:30. My name is John Wallace. I'm on the teaching staff here at Holden. This week I've been talking about ideas about how societies work and trying to lay out sort of a theory. I don't know, theory's too grand a word for it. Kind of conceptual framework for how we think about societies work. I'm an economist, and we've been talking about lots of different things besides economics. We've been talking about cognitive science and emotions and rationality and how people make decisions, as well as how groups form. And I know we have some people who haven't been here so far this week, and I'll try to give you a very brief overview of where we've been over the last 3 days to kind of frame some of the things that we're talking about. Historically, until about 10,000 years ago, there's no evidence in the archaeological record that groups of more than 30 persisted for any period of time. I mean, that doesn't mean there weren't groups of 50, hunting and gathering bands of 50 or so. And there were maybe loose tribes of 200 or something like that. But that there were really, actually, human units were quite small. And until about 10,000 years ago, which we identify as the Neolithic Revolution or the Agricultural Revolution or the Urban Revolution, we begin to see larger human habitations. They actually get quite big quite fast. So that's one thing that we want to think about. The second thing is that about 200 years ago, even though societies did not necessarily get bigger, there was a marked increase in the level of economic activity. Sort of, we call that the Industrial Revolution. Or Patricia Gall, who was doing Bible studies this week, who just left, would have called maybe the Stuff Revolution. Okay, and you see this sharp upturn in all kinds of things. We get more people, we get more stuff, but we also get more political development, we get more social development, we get religious freedom, we get all kinds of things happening that are, sometimes social scientists call this modernity or modern development. Okay, there's a modernization hypothesis out there about all the kind of things that happened together about 200 years ago. If you listen to Butch Thomas talk about Scott Joplin, he talks about how all of a sudden at the end of the 19th century this music spreads throughout the world. And Butch's framework of this is how sort of American music finally comes together in a way that influences the world. But that spreadingness is something that's happening in many dimensions. It's not happening everywhere in the world, because this spreadingness, even as we know today, has happened in about 25 countries. So that, as we saw in Barb Rossing's statistics this morning, for those of you at the Bible study, the United States and Europe have about 10% of the world's population and consume about 70% of the world's resources. That's not unfair, by the way. The rest of the world can consume their resources they wanted to. Okay? They're stuck in societies that don't work very well. Okay, and there's lots of reasons we talked about it. Now, I know that was just provocative, but that's exactly what we're talking about. How societies are organized, how societies work. So we've also talked about how the place to start with societies is how individuals worked. We've talked about how although people are rational, they're also emotional, and that there's a lot of new and exciting work in cognitive science, in psychology, in economics, in various kinds of fields about how people make decisions, and that emotions frame the decisions that we make. So people are not hyper-rational. And our emotions are actually not, the word that an economist would use is exogenous, that is, they don't come in from the outside with no reason. Our bodies learn how to build emotions that help us make decisions. So that our emotions are, in fact, sort of in some way a distillation of the things that we've learned, so that our minds and our bodies can access that information very quickly. So we don't have to think about it. So we feel ways. Okay? And that turns out to be linked to the way our body actually monitors its internal functions, so that when you get angry, you feel angry. It isn't just that you have this intellectual, rational thing. When you get scared, you feel scared. When you get excited, you feel excited. And in fact, that emotionalness, so we think of feelings as what's going on inside of us, and emotions as being the outward expression of us. All of us are geared to reading emotions in each other. People who are severely deficient in the ability to read and to think to read emotions in others are artistic. They can't sense. So people who can't read what other people are doing don't have a very difficult time behaving in society because they don't know how their behavior is being reacted to. Now that means that when we think about groups of people, we have a strong ability to connect emotionally with other people and to build relationships of trust in which we can believe that we can predict how the other people behave, we can actually make agreements that can last through time, but that requires us to have personal knowledge of the other person, and that means that groups are typically limited to about 30. And 30 has been a magic number this week. It's coming up more and more. Came up in Matins this morning with David Brower Rieke's farewell address, you might say, farewell reading of Leviticus, that if we rely on personal knowledge, that's it. We can't get bigger societies than that. So we can have more people, we can have larger populations, but the actual units of society that work will be about 30. And we know that until about 10,000 years ago, that was the real constraint. So we don't see society. There's no record archaeological. In order for 10,000 people to live together, it leaves a mark. 50,000 years from now, they will know that Holden Village was here. Okay? If somebody comes looking for it, those tailings are going to stick out forever. Okay, unless there's a big earthquake and everything gets folded in. But for a long time, they're going to know people were at Holden Village. Now, the first place that we have evidence on had 8,000 people in it. Much more people than actually exist in Holden Village, which is kind of a big jump from 30 to 8,000. Well, how does that happen? Well, if we think about how people work, there's got to be some way to allow people to trust each other, right? To believe that if their coordinated activities will work. And the problem is that if I make a decision based on the fact that Art and I are going to cooperate, and I invest a lot of this relationship, and then Art walks, I lose. And in fact, he may walk away with the collective good. How can I trust him? Well, I trust him because I know him. He's part of my family. I have a gen. My sons are right here. They'll undoubtedly be examples tonight of certain kinds of things. Raise your hands. Okay. Each one of them shares half of my genes. They share a quarter with each other. So I'm more closely related to them than they are to each other. Possibly. Yeah. Dan's pointed out that he may not be related to me at all. It's just on average that he has maybe half of my genes. So how do we get to people who are not personally interacting? How do we get a group that's bigger than 30? And so yesterday we talked about what? I call the natural state. I have a book that I've written about this with a couple of other people that I've talked about at Holden the last couple summers. The nature state. That's not it. And the natural state works by powerful individuals making arrangements with one another. We call this the Don John world at Holden Village because Don and John were the two first big guys, the warlords that we had. So the powerful individuals. Let's try to figure out some way to trust one another. And the simple way of thinking about this is that Don's the head of one group and John's the head of another group. Initially, perhaps, these have 30 people in them. And Don and John agree to enforce, to divide the world in the middle. What we do is we usually divide koinonia in the middle. We have Don over here and John over here. And John owns all the people on this half of the room, and Don owns all the people on this half of the room. And they own all their output, all the land, the labor, the capital. And so what happens if Don and John start fighting to the productivity of everybody in the room? It goes down, right? In fact, if you live in a world of hunter-gatherer tribes, productivity is actually quite low. It turns out not to take that much time to eat, because the Lord has provided this bountiful goodness. But you have to spend a lot of time defending yourself. To devote a lot of resources to something that generates a return to you, but not a productive return. Defending yourself is a really good thing if you're about to be killed, right? But it doesn't produce more goods and services or more things. So that by Don and John reaching this agreement with one another, Don and John trust each other, but trust in verified sense. They don't think that they have each other's interests at heart. It's not like my relationship with my children. The Don knows that if John fights, John's organization, his clients, they become less productive and John loses directly from being violent. So that enables Don to believe potentially that John won't fight, for John to believe potentially that Don won't fight. Okay, see the logic there? Otherwise, Don puts down his rock, John kills him and tries to take over the world. So the presence of this organization, the Don's organization and John's organization, John's group, makes the relationship between John and Don feasible. But now what we've done is we've created a society with 60 people. And in fact, because Don now has an agreement with John, Don can call on John to deal with his people. So in hunting and gathering societies, they're aggressively egalitarian. The leader is not the first among equals. They tend to lead from behind. So the main responsibility of the leader is to be generous. And if a leader gets too big for his britches, ultimately you just kill him. Okay? But if John is willing to come to Don's aid, and these guys both have rocks or weapons, or they become a military elite and train, a more complicated society, then Don can actually coordinate agreements with his clients, if you will, that couldn't be done if you just had to have face-to-face personal relationships. So Don's group can get bigger, and John's group can get bigger. And in fact, this is too simple of representation. The guy, the Don Johns, there's probably 12 of them or 15 of them, not just two of them. So this provides a way to organize society in a way that people can trust each other, but they're not trusting each other in the way of the genetic personal trust through personal knowledge. They're trusting each other because they've socially created a set of interests that are readily observable to the powerful parties. And so these guys can actually coordinate and cooperate. And this is the world that emerges 10,000 years ago. Now, what also happens in this emergence is that we begin to get rules. Don and John don't write laws and have a legislature and that sort of stuff. They just have ways of dealing with one another. The first rule is probably that when Don says help, John shows up, and vice versa. But as they begin to get more complicated structures here, it becomes possible to build on the innate tendency of people to relate to one another, to build relationships through personal relationships, right, with a few rules. Now, and this is kind of standing the way we usually think of this on its head, that human beings are built for relationships. So Tuesday I talked about incomplete relationships. That in this room, we all have a relationship, but I don't personally know all of you. I only know personally a couple of you. And some of us have a long history. Most of us don't. And so we're not dividing up into groups of 30 and killing each other and doing all that kind of stuff, because we live in a society that provides lots of, I could call them rules, we could call them laws, we could also call them norms of behavior, that is ways in which we readily deal with one another. On Monday night, David Brower-Rieke talked about the statement on sexuality, trust, and faith. Is that right?
Faith?
What?
Gift and trust.
Gift and trust. I can't never remember that. Just like Richard, Phil. Yeah. I know it's Phil now, but I'm going to call him Rich sooner or later. Or some other name, Bob, Bill. I do that all the time. Dex and Dan. I forgot.
Gift and trust.
What was I talking about?
Norms.
Over the village.
Relationships. What? He said that the thing people don't like about the statement is it doesn't give them real clear rules.
That's right. It doesn't give them clear rules. So the whole statement about faith and trust is about relationships.
Yeah.
And about how people should relate to one another. And the model for that is the family, and how the church should have an approach to sexuality that makes families work. So there's some questions about you know, gay and lesbian couples and how they should be in lifelong monogamous marriage, how you do that. But people really want to know the rule. They don't want to know the rule because they want to live by the rule. Okay? They don't want the law because they want to live by the law. They want the rule because they want to have a relationship where if it's potentially going to break down or if they get to a rough spot, they know what's going to happen because the rule gives them a predictable way of resolving their differences. Okay? So rules enable relationships. And larger social organizations are built on incomplete relationships. Most of what's going on between Don and John and all these people is still based on relationships, not on rules. They only need a couple of rules. But without the rules, they can't get the bigger scale. Now, in the real world, there'll be Don and John, there'll be the military specialist, there'll be a priest, and a trader, and a politician. There'll be a group of elites that have special privileges. I'll talk about those specifically in terms of organizations in just a minute. The big thing they have is access to rules that the other ones will enforce. These are rules that are enforced by a third party, somebody outside the relationship. So the key with the sexuality statement in the ELCA, we've had this debate over rostering, whether a member of the clergy who is in an active, same-sex, long-term, publicly recognized and accountable relationship should be on the roster or not. And the current rule is no. The current practice is, in some places, yes, in some places, no. Right? The practice is based on a norm and a relationship between the bishop and the congregation and the pastor. Right? So do we want to enforce that rule or not? Well, kind of what triggered the current situation was in 2007 when a pastor in Atlanta actually told his bishop, hey, you know what? I found somebody. And I'm entering into a lifelong monogamous relationship with this person, and the bishop read the rules and said, you're out. You're off the roster. So the rule isn't shaping the relationships, but the rule nonetheless does come into play when there's a difference of opinion about the relationship breaking down and what the, you know. Does everybody see that difference? We tend to think of laws as providing the frame for our lives. Relationships provide the frame for our lives. My life is defined by my children, by my spouse, by my family, by my employment, which is basically not defined as the University of Maryland, it's the Department of Economics and the people in it. There are nonetheless rules, but I don't think of my life as being defined by the tax code, right? I don't drive according to the rules. Dexton Dan will tell you, 55 is just a number to me. So the key here is that we can build larger social organizations if we use rules that can be enforced by somebody. Now, if we think about this, Don and John, in what we could call the dominant coalition, that's what I call it, you don't need to worry about this term, can Don and John call on anybody else to enforce their rules? Nope, they can't, right? Because there's nobody else out here, there's God, maybe. But there's no other third party. If they're the kick-ass guys in this society, and if they can't get together, there's nobody else out there to do it. Okay. Don and John in their internal organizations can call on each other so they can, in fact, access third-party enforcement. They can make rules or norms or laws that, in fact, everybody can see this is how it will be, and they know if you're in Don's group, you know it's going to be enforced because Don and John are collectively powerful enough to make you obey the rule, to punish you if you defect from the contract. We all know that if we break a law, nothing may happen to us. But if something does happen to us and the government decides that we're going to be punished, what's going to happen? We're going to be punished. Okay? Unless we want to have a revolution and overthrow the United States government, effectively, it's going to be impossible for us to do that. Now, in this world, that's always a much iffier kind of thing. These guys, they have to have self-enforcing rules. What makes their ability, what is it that makes them able to reach an agreement that allows them to have a bigger group than 30? Pardon? Third party. But they're the third party. What? Trust. They don't have a third party.
Trust.
No. Where does the trust come from? They don't have mutual interests. Right? So Don and John may have completely different interests. It's not that they share the same interests. John wants to exploit the hell out of these people. Don wants to get as much out of these guys as he can. They don't have mutual interests. Don would love to kill John. Okay, but if he does, he knows he's going to lose, so it's not in his self-interest to do that. What?
Self-preservation.
Self-preservation, their self-interest, but what is it? Okay. What is it that gives them the self-interest, the treasure, right, that motivates them? Where's it coming from?
Well, the rents that they
have. Yeah. Now, we use the word rents for an economist for return above alternative uses. It's kind of like gravy. You know, Michael, Kobe Bryant plays basketball for the LA Lakers for $21 million a year. I'm sure he'd be willing to pay for $1 million. So he's getting a $20 million rent. So if you lowered his salary by $1 million, he wouldn't quit playing basketball, right? Because he'd still be getting now $19 million. He'd be getting $19 million in gravy. But if the Lakers lower his salary by $2 million a year, what will he do? He'll go to the Houston Rockets or another team, because there is another team that's willing to pay $20 million for him to play. So Kobe gets $20 million in rents, gravy, from playing basketball. But he only gets maybe $1 million in rents from playing for the Lakers. Where does your gravy come from? Which side is your bread buttered on? These guys have rents. And where do the rents come from? Yeah. Now, what creates this stronger organization that produces the rents? The rules. And what enables the rules to sustain? Third party. Okay? In other words, you can't generate the rents that'll hold this agreement together unless those rents are based in these organizations, and the existence of those organizations is based upon the rules that these guys are called to enforce. All three of those pieces have to fit together, because if they don't fit together, it will be in somebody's self-interest not to cooperate, and the whole thing will go. Now, I know that's a lot to swallow. But it's really important. And here's why. The rules that societies adopt, from the point of view of an individual, just come out of the sky. Right? I mean, I don't have any ability to influence the speed limit, as I've proven over and over again. I mean, I could organize politically to get a coalition to elect somebody to change the speed limit. I mean, I know how to do it. It's very expensive, so I don't. But so I take the laws as given. But are the laws of society given to society? No, they're not. They're inherently part of the way that society works. And some rules, which don't fit with these interests, they may be on the books and people just ignore them. Holden has lots of rules like that. You know, they come and go with summer to summer and thing to thing. Used to be a rule if you peed in the toilet, you didn't flush. I thought it was a gross rule. But then I'm a guy and I thought you could live with it. Well, then we don't have that rule anymore. Why? Well, because it's not a rule, but because, in fact, people stopped obeying it. What's the dynamic? What's the relationship? Rules have to be consistent with the society that we live in. And that means two things. One, that you can't impose rules on society. You impose rules on people that are not consistent with their self-interest, they won't obey them.
Well, actually, John, the let it mellow.
Yes, I know, that was it.
Actually, people didn't flush enough, so there wasn't enough water to run the...
the septic system.
Run the septic system, so we didn't have enough. The bacteria were all not able to do their job.
So what happened? That's a much better example than I have. Right? I mean, we could say, oh, you know what? We all value saving water, so we don't want people to flush their toilets, but we're up here at home, we need water in the septic system, so it's not sustainable.
An unintended consequence.
And in fact, this has to be a world in which the unintended consequences all work in the right way, or it blows up. Now, today, in the Bible study and at the proclamation, we read the following about laws about land in Israel. Leviticus 25:23. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. This is God talking. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. Now, what does it mean that the land shall not be sold in perpetuity? You heard Barbara talk about this morning in the Bible study several times.
It means you can sell it to somebody, but they don't get to keep it forever and ever and ever. More
of a
lease then?
Yeah, but okay, that's what it means not to sell it in perpetuity. They don't get to keep it forever and ever and ever. Okay, but let's think about that. Who owns the land in perpetuity? It turns out the Levites can. Right? If you're in a walled city, you can buy land, and after the year you can own it in perpetuity. So what does owning in perpetuity mean? That you can own it forever and ever and ever and ever, right? Now how many of you are gonna live forever and ever and ever and ever and ever? None of you? I'll make that prediction. I know it's bold. Okay. So what does it mean to have land in perpetuity if you don't own, if you don't live forever? Well, one possibility is you pass it on to your heirs. Okay. But we talked this morning about the, I don't read the whole chapter. Who does the land actually revert to in the story? What?
God.
God.
Family.
Clans. Tribes. Groups. Okay, why might perpetual ownership of land in a group be different than perpetual ownership of land by an individual? Can an individual own land perpetually? No, only until they die. Then there has to be some sort of transfer. The transfer could be to your children. Depends on what the inheritance law is. The background for the Jubilee story is that the land is collectively owned by the tribe or the family or the nation. Different translations give different words, and I know no Hebrew. You know, it's not even Greek to me. In some sense, the ownership of the land is, where is the ownership of the land on this thing?
Maybe.
How many Dons and Johns were there in Israel?
12.
At least 12, right? But Israel was set up as a real natural state. They had groups. They had inheritance lines, they had cultural lines, they had different functions across the groups, they had laws, they had lots of times when this thing broke down into civil war. We'd have several kings, right? Or different pieces like that. So this group, this kind of organization, was in fact who owned the land in some sense. Own is a very, very complicated word that seems simple when we say it. So that how could... You can see how an organization can own things perpetually. You know, this is the Levites' land. In fact, in the chapter it says, oh, the Levites can do all this. They can own their land in perpetuity. It becomes the priest's land. When the priests buy it, everybody else is going to go back to God. Of course, he represents God. Well, the priest. Yeah. I mean, complicated things here.
And who made the rules?
Who made the rules? Well, of course, now, I hope you're all thinking about that just a little bit differently. Then somebody arbitrarily imposes rules on these guys. Because if you arbitrarily impose rules on a society that don't work and the septic tank goes dry, what happens to the rule?
It gets discarded
or it gets changed. Okay, a rule has to be consistent with the dynamics of society, right? With a changing nature, because the world is always changing. Now, this is a theme I've touched on the first 3 days a lot. The logic of the rules is not the logic of the individual. Okay, it's not even the logic of the family. Because the logic of the family is based on trust. It's based on personal interaction and repeated personal interaction. So that your continued relationship is what sustains your relationship. But the rules are designed to cover the gaps when relationships break down, when relationships are incomplete. And that's what's enabling this larger society to form. So the logic of the rules cannot be the logic of the family. Otherwise families would be huge, or could potentially be. So the rules have to follow this dynamic of these interactions. how could you get
a perpetual organization?
Well, wait, no, before I go on, ask that. Now I remember. What did David say about the thinking about rules? Because here I've drawn a very stylized. You know, there's the Don John rules that apply to everybody else. What did David Brower-Rieke say? If you remember on Monday night, about how many protections there are in federal law for marriages?
A thousand.
Okay? So that when two people get married, there are 1,000 rules. You know, they're not laws about criminal intent. They're just kind of, how do people relate to one another? And what are the default rules? I've been divorced. Unfortunately, Dexter and Dan's mom and I were divorced. And we had to go through all this rule stuff. And our relationship was in trouble. Obviously, we got divorced. And it turned out that when we got divorced, we could agree about certain things. We love Dex and Dan, do what we can for them. And other sort of things, it was really hard to agree on. So what do? The rules. There are rules. And the rules in Maryland are different than the rules in Washington, that are different than the rules in California, because in our society, states make the rules regarding marriage. So there's a whole bunch of rules out there that aren't really like speeding laws or criminal laws. They're just things that say, here's what relationships actually look like. And every single marriage is different, so no marriage is actually governed by the rules unless it falls apart. And when it falls apart, the rules can become really, really important. So marriages are incomplete relationships. They're relationships that should, in the gospel and in the church, be completely about the union of two people and their children and their family. And all of us who are lucky enough to have completely that relationship love it. And sometimes those relationships go kink, and the rules have to come into play. The rules have to come into play because some people have children, and we need to know how those children are going to be taken care of. Because if the two people screw up bad enough that neither one of them is doing it, we need to know, all of us want to know how those kids are being taken care of, right? So those 1,000 protections are not criminal laws. They are nonetheless rules about how people relate to one another. Don't ever think that we live in a society without rules, and that some of the rules that we never ever see aren't important. We live in a world where there are persistent ways of relating to one another that we see, we learn about, and where do those ways of dealing with one another get embedded in our brains? I'm sorry, it's in the rational part? No, in the emotional part. If you marry somebody who only deals with you with their neocortex, with the rational part, you're going to be very unhappy. Because there's going to be all kinds of promises that you guys make that then, oh, you know, we got to worry about. You know, rationality can be really bad for marriages. So can emotion. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that it always is. We got to feel this, right? And you hope you're married to somebody who you have pretty much the same feelings about what is right. That makes being married a whole lot easier. Okay. Now, where am I here? I don't know. Organizations need rules. They can be formal rules, they can be informal norms, but they need to be things that can be that can help people through periods in which their relationships aren't working. They can be enforced internally, or they can be enforced externally with third parties or internal. Very often, rules that are internal to organizations work because there's the presence of a third party. So even though it seems like there's no third party, there's a shadow. So Holden Village may seem to be self-sustaining, but as soon as you start poking around in the nooks and crannies, there's the Forest Service, there's the Department of, there's the EPA, there's the Department of Ecology, there's the Chelan School District, there's the Washington State Police, there's the Washington State Legal Code, there's all kinds of stuff that frame our ability to conduct a relationship. We hope and pray that all of our entire relationship is a relationship, and that we never break down into that incompleteness and need the rules. Okay? But we do, actually, turns out, need those rules sometimes. And because we do need them and use them, we live, and here I'm going to say, in the shadow of them. I'm not on that cross. Christ was on that cross. But I'm a Lutheran, So I live in the shadow of that cross. Right? It shapes my life. Rules do that. So what does it mean for an organization? What does it mean for land to be owned perpetually? Well, it means, perhaps, that there's an organization that we perceive living on beyond the lives of its members, like the clan. Or like the family, not in the nuclear family sense, but the extended family sense of multi-generation, right? That organizations of people can persist through time. They can adopt their own internal rules and in fact, adopt an identity.
Our church.
What?
Our church.
Our church, right.
Or like the gentleman pointed out this morning, the corporation.
The corporation. The corporation is a formal legal entity. Okay, and this morning, Dale pointed out how evil they were. So what's Holden Village? It's a corporation. Okay. Organizations as formal legal entities, as what are called legal persons, have existed in Western law since the Roman times. Some summers I've talked a lot about that, and this is a research interest of mine, so we could talk about it for weeks. I'm not going to go too much into the details of that. But we can talk about an organization as a legal entity that has an identity that extends beyond the life of its members, and then we can begin to talk about perpetually lived organizations, even if the organization doesn't exist for perpetuity. Now, where I want to go with this, however, is that organizations only exist in the presence of rules. The rules have got to be sustainable. That is, they've got to be consistent with the actual way that the society works. So much of what we think about as development is ways for societies to organize themselves. And the skeleton that gets left over history tends to be the rules rather than the relationships. Okay? And there's those Leviticus chapters, they love your neighbor, you know, be good, do all that, you know. You kind of, well, how did they enforce those? Right? Well, those were rules, but they were, you know, obviously they weren't rules that, because how do you, you know, enforce people being nice? Okay. But there were ways to structure relationships and organizations. Now, a very important, is everybody, you can interrupt me anytime, because I interrupt myself all the time. So it's not like there's a nice linear flow going here, you know. So, but does everybody see kind of this notion about rules and organizations and why that's a dynamic that's somewhat different than the personal relationships between individuals and how that enables scale to occur?
Question.
Yep.
Could you say something about the role of sin and how it enables rules to extend beyond personal relationships?
Well, I think one of the things that happens here is violence is an inherent part of the human condition. One can call that.
Or even just deciding, you know, be nice to your neighbors, or, you know, right, any slice of the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And the consequence of sin by violating them.
Well, okay, which consequence are you talking about?
Well, just the simple proposition that if you don't abide by the Ten Commandments, you have sinned. And therefore, all the consequences that are understood that go with sin,
right,
then make those consequences less abstract and more personal.
Okay. Yeah. So that's okay. Let me read you something. This is from a book called The Ten Grandmothers, which Paul Hinderly lent to me last fall. I haven't finished it, so I haven't given it back to him. The book is, it interviews with people from the Kiowa Indian tribe in Oklahoma that were taken in the 1930s, but stretched back to memories that went back as early as the 1840s and 50s. So it's divided into four sections. One's when the buffalo were there, when the buffalo were declining, when the buffalo were gone, and now, modern times. And so I'm in the middle of the third section, when the buffalo were gone, and several times Indian leaders have said, if we do X, the buffalo will come back. And so, but several of those things have already failed in the history of the tribe. So Wooden Lance is a guy who's heard about what's going to be the Indian uprisings of the 1890s, with many Indians saying, we just kill all the white people, the buffalo will come back. Wooden Lance Sugar said, I don't know about that, about these ideas that if we believe if we do X, Y will happen. If we kill all the white people, the buffalo will come back. He said, there was this buffalo coming out ceremony we had a while ago. It was about the same thing. If everybody believed, the buffalo would come back, and the old days would come back. That's where these coming back beliefs are different from others. Everybody has to believe, or they're no good. For just a few people to believe, just the ones who want to believe, won't work. Everybody, all the Indians, have to believe, or it's no good to anybody. Now, what's a sin?
Separation from God. That's what we're told.
It's a breaking relationship.
Yes.
That was not a trivial question. Right? What are the ways of behaving such that the consequences for us are immediate and negative?
Yeah, how do you feel the rules?
Right. Okay. So we have ways of belief about, and I'm by no means, and those of you who've been here, you know, I'm not like, oh, I'm an economist, I believe all this religion stuff is crazy. People have to believe. And partly what we believe and teach is, we teach our children, if you behave a certain ways, you'll pay. You'll pay right now in your life, right? And if we all share that belief, and we honestly share it, right, then we will all act in ways that are predictable. Okay? So one thing we would like to have in a community is shared beliefs. What?
That's ethics, not sin.
Yeah, that's ethics. That's it. These are all, I think, related to the same problem. I mean, I don't know, because I don't know what ethics are. I've already admitted that. I have trouble with that. So that, how do we do that? Okay. Now, many times at Holden in the last 4 days, in fact, our summer theme is about treasure. You know, what do people value? What does God value? What should we value? If we just all valued the environment more, wouldn't we stop wrecking our world? Or if we believe this, if we all believe this, wouldn't the world be a better place? Okay. And I think this is an incredibly important problem. And answering it is one that always, whether it's ethics or sin, occupy people, because we are always worrying about which of our individual behaviors will lead us to be happier and better off, or are the people we care for to be happier and better off, and which will be destructive? What is right and what is wrong, right? What will lead us to integrate with our society better? Okay. And I think all that is really, really important. And part of that comes out of the community that we live in and how it is shaped. Okay. So that our notions, and I don't want to become completely relevant, you know, what we think is right and wrong depends on who we live with and what, you know, I don't think it's all relative. I think there's some real inherentness to some of these kind of problems. Why does organization shape people's ethics and moral sense about sin, about what they should do? Well, that's why I spend so much time on Monday and Tuesday talking about emotions and rationality. We are inherently endowed with the ability to watch how other people behave and sense their emotional states. And we are programmed to deal with people as people and build relationships. But when we get to the point where our societies get bigger, we have organizations, we have groups, which are bigger than we can all know personally. And those groups are shaped by rules. In fact, they don't exist if there's not rules that are self-sustaining. So what are our beliefs? Are the beliefs of people who live in societies where the groups are 10,000 people going to be different than the people that live in societies where the groups are 30? And the answer is yes. Okay. Exactly how they're going to be different, I can't tell you. But there's going to be a sense in everybody of the moral and ethical rightness of certain rules that will be reinforced because to the extent that people obey those rules, we see that behavior as being the way the world works. In fact, most of us will see those rules as not being artificial, but being an inherent part of human nature. Right? If you live in one society where everybody has a common belief, you see that as being part of inherently human rather than the result of a social construction. Yeah, I'm sorry, Art, you had your hand, but go ahead and then we'll come back.
So just to add on to that, so then really then whatever a certain particular society deems as good or bad or a rule or ethical, if it works for them, it works for them. It's neither bad nor good. It works for them. Is that the piece that you're...
Okay, I got this sin ethics right wrong thing. I don't want to go to deconstruction and saying this that morals and ethics are all relative, because there may be things that people agree on that they all think are wrong. Right? So I don't want to get into I don't know how to do the right wrong thing.
I'm not pushing you in that direction. Right. I'm just saying, is that kind of what we're going to boil this thing to? Is that?
No, I think I'm not trying to. Yeah. No. That societies actually do function on either formal rules or norms or beliefs about things that work for that society. People who live in those societies see those kinds of behavior shaped by that as natural. Whether they see it as the right way or not isn't clear. Believe me, we've all, as Lutherans, been taught that some parts of human society are not good. Right? How many times have you heard this is a broken world? That we're broken pots. The story last night. I love the story. I'm not complaining about the story, but we believe that. We believe that certain relatively dependable parts of our world are evil. Okay? So it is that, but nonetheless, our society works in the sense that those things are part of the expectations about what people have, and we need those things, the good or the bad ones of them, because if we get rid of all the rules, what happens? We go back to 30 people. I'm not kidding. It's really important to understand that if we decide that we're going to mess with society too much, we can blow the whole thing up. Because guess what human history tells us? Societies blow up all the time. Okay? I do want to get to that point, but I want to say that's part of understanding the dynamic. Here I'm getting... This is really fun, so I don't want to move on from it, but I do want to get to one more thing. But Art, and then...
I'm just going to throw out something, and this is my own thought, and I'll let you explain it better.
Okay.
But my own belief is that an ideal set of rules for the community is a set of rules that minimizes neighborhood effects.
Okay.
And that, you know, something like sin is obviously going to... it's going to raise the neighborhood effects of.
Right.
And okay. So if you look at the Cosa Nostra, you know, for that community, their rules, effectively minimize their neighborhood effects.
Right. So in a constant say these are external, you know, the effects of my behavior on other people.
Right.
Right. We want to encourage those effects that are positive, and discourage those effects that are negative, and so that's one way. There's actually a formal theory. You can write down mathematics of this to say what would an optimal set of rules be. Okay. Yeah, so that idea is very much a powerful one. In fact, something called institutional economics. There's a man named Oliver Williamson who teaches at Berkeley who has precisely that kind of view about what would an optimal set of rules look like. Okay. So that I agree. I don't think optimal sets of rules are what this is about. but you could think about the abstract problem that way.
Even in this situation, the little d's and the little j's most likely prosper from Don and John having formed this coalition.
No, there's no doubt about the fact that the little d's are probably better off being in than they would be out. But would the little d's like to be Don? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so, you know, yeah. Right. No, there's a social gain here.
Great.
And I would agree with that completely. But there's also complications about how this is organized. Now, okay. All right. The point I want to make next, and this is what I was supposed to talk about today, but maybe we'll be talking about tomorrow, in personality anonymity. This arrangement enables people to deal with people that they don't know personally. Right? Some of the D's and J's can deal with one another, even though they never met anybody before, because they can identify who they are socially. Everybody knows whether they're Don or John's guy, right? The Israelites know what tribe they're in. There's a social structure that they can use to identify people. So individuals' personal identity is attached to the groups that they're part of. And in fact, as we move up from the little D's to the bigger D's, right? And there's a higher, in most societies, the elites are 5 or 10% of the population. So there's a real hierarchy at the top. You know, the differentiation between the different kinds of priests and the different kinds of aristocrats and the different kinds of kings, whether businessmen are on the top or on the bottom, and the whole kind of hierarchy. What matters for those people is a personal identity with the social organizations that they're part of. This system works, and another way to say it besides the natural state, is that this is a limited access order, social order, where the only people who can access the third-party enforcement of the rules about how to form organizations are the people at the top. So the way in which the little D's are kept powerless is not so much by going around and beating them over the head all the time, because you don't want to do that. You want to wage peace, not war. You don't want to try to coerce people by threatening them. But these guys don't have access to the third-party enforcement that these guys do. So powerful individuals, the rents, are created largely because they are in a situation in which, because they belong to the elites, they can draw on organizational tools, and therefore they're more productive. They may be more productive economically, in the sense that they're producers or traders. They may be more productive religiously, in the sense that they're priests. They may be more productive politically, in the sense that they're military leaders or negotiators. They may be more productive in terms of education, in the sense that they're running a school. So there's all kinds of ways in which the productivity and the rents accrue to the guys. That, you know, oftentimes this guy's not always. It was Jezebel was threatening Elijah the other day. That their access to the rules enables them to create value and rents, which are holding the society together.
Is that game mentality?
What?
That game?
A gang, a crip. This you can use this to describe crime families perfectly. Okay, this really works because there's the crime lords, the guys, the heads of the families, you know, and the Godfather. They get together and they can't call on any outside parties because they can't get their agreements can't get enforced by the courts. So they're the heads. They have lieutenants. They have minions in the crime families. All the minions know exactly whose crime family they're part of. You know, they deal with one another across crime families until a gang war breaks out, and then all of a sudden, boom, they're on separate sides of the fence. Yeah, that's a perfect example.
So the group's identity becomes more important
than that. Oh, very much so. In this kind of world, your returns come from the fact that you belong to an organization. Right? So do you value organizations or rules more? The organization. I talked about what happened in Kenya last year when the election broke down. The two parties started fighting, and they were forced to be on one side or the other. There was no middle ground anymore. And that meant that your interests lie with the organization. Now, these rules work because they're personal, because the kind of rule that applies depends upon who you are. Literally, the rules that work in John's group might be different than the rules that work in Don's group. You know, the Irish might have different ways of doing things than the Italians in the crime family. The Lutherans and the Catholics, you know, they have different rules. The Calvinists and the Lutherans split up because they don't believe really different stuff. I mean, you know, they have different rules for how they want to organize the pieces. So the notion of personal rules means that you have rules But the rules do not apply equally to everybody, in the sense that there's biased enforcement of the rules. And if we begin to move this into laws, we can easily see why some laws are enforced for some people but not for others. Okay, think about Jim Crow laws in the South. When blacks and whites, with equal protection of the law was supposedly in existence because of Plessy versus Ferguson, but in fact was not. Right? But another way to think about this is that in this situation, there's different rules for different people. So certain rules apply to the king, apply to the duke, apply to the pope, apply to the bishop. And what are the most important rules about? Forming organizations. How do we act together? How do we relate? What? Relationships. Yeah. I mean, most of the rules that matter are about relationships. Some of the rules, like the criminal, are about two individuals who happen to interact in a particularly inappropriate way. Okay, but most of the law in our society is about relationships. It's not about two unrelated individuals, it's about two related individuals. And their relationship is under the law, and I want you to reverse that and say, no, the law is under their relationship. Okay, it's bridging over the pieces, and the relationships can be whatever they want. Now, what that means is that everybody here in the society is a unique individual, not only as individuals as God made them, but in some sense with respect to the rules, they're unique. Is there much equality in this world?
Nope.
Nope. There's only equality in the sense that you're a little D and that you're a peon, and that you're equal only in your littleness. And as we all know, are peasant societies one in which everybody's the same? No, they're ones in which everybody's different. Who's your daddy? Who's your mommy? Who's your cousin? Where do you live? Where's your land? What's your peace? All the stuff in Leviticus. Right? Although Leviticus is all about your brother falling into poverty and your relation falling into poverty and your peace and the people that you're connected. It doesn't say you should help all men. In fact, if some alien's stupid enough to walk into your town, you enslave him. Okay? So how do we get to impersonality? How do we get to societies where we say the rules apply equally to everybody and the same rule applies equally to everyone? In the United States, if you want to form a church today, as long as you're not killing people, right, you're not doing anything to damage people illegally in your organization, you can go to the Secretary of State in the state of Washington, pay some fee, I don't know, it's probably $500 now, and incorporate as a church. Which means you can own property, you can raise money, you can receive gifts, you can do all kinds of things, and the laws of the state of Washington, not only with respect to individuals, but with respect to groups, will apply to you. Can anybody be denied that right? No. And that means that law applies impersonally. Equally we like. Yeah. Equally has these warm, fuzzy implications. Okay? But impersonally means everybody gets treated the same. Now, the dynamics of the rules in the Don John world, right? This business about right and wrong and stuff, rarely produce rules that are impersonal. Because in order to sustain the rules, the powerful individuals in this society must find it in their interest to sustain the rules when called upon, to not go to civil war. And that typically means the rules are different. But we live in a society where we know that not all the laws apply equally to everybody, and not everybody has exactly the same rules. But by and large, we live in a society in which the rules are the same for everybody. Okay? In fact, we, in the sin emotional sense, we believe very strongly that anything the government does, no matter how stupid it is, should apply to all of us the same. Right? It fries us. It makes us mad when somebody gets a tax break. We don't believe in from each according to your ability, to each according to your needs. We believe everybody ought to be treated the same. Now, that causes some problems sometimes, because treating everybody the same is really hard. We like equality, We would like to be treat everybody according to their needs. But that means inherently we treat everybody differently. Now we have this problem, was that we know this organization at the top has to be self-enforcing. The United States government has to be a self-enforcing organization because there's no third party out there. So we want the interests of our leaders to be such that they play nicely with one another. Did they always do that? 1861, Civil War. So we have in our society, and this is true of every developed society, and not true of every not developed society. I know that's a big assertion. Have developed societies that actually are capable of implementing impersonal rules, and the most important are impersonal rules about forming organizations. So that at some point, about 200 years ago, America, Britain, France, Western Europe in general, although not completely, Germany doesn't get there until the beginning of the 20th century, figured out ways for to allow people to form organizations. As I mentioned yesterday, the first general incorporation law in America was for churches in New York in 1783. If you've ever read the Federalist Paper number 10, if you've read George Washington's farewell address, the founding fathers in the United States were terrified of political parties and corporations of organized economic interests. And they wrote over and over and over about it. Didn't Mal here talk about the intellectual history of this. But by 1850, the United States has the first mass political parties, and it has widespread general incorporation laws. It allows organizations to form across a wide variety of things with the same rules. Now that's the legal tip of that iceberg. What do we call, does anybody, if you do political theory or political science, we call it civil society. Robert Putnam, a famous sociologist, has written about the book called Bowling Alone, okay, which is that developed societies have this very rich civic life in which the political decision-making process is constrained by the presence of many, many cross-cutting groups within the population, some religious, some educational, some social, some whatever. If you want to, as we've been learning from Mel, if you want to form a communist organization in the United States, you can go right ahead and do it. Overthrowing the government and killing other people, those are problematic areas. So it's actually okay to overthrow the government, as long as you just advocate it, right? But we have, Western Europe has a completely different set of rules about how it interacts, right? Western Europe doesn't look like the United States with respect to taking care of poor people. It doesn't look like the United States when it comes to health insurance. Does it look like the United States when it comes with regard to all kinds of things? Some things in Europe I like better, some things in America I like better. But in both societies, in both cultures, the basic rules about forming organizations are anybody can do it who wants to. And that changes the dynamics of the way the system works. Okay, I'm sorry that I've talked too much tonight. And it's 20 after 7. But I promise, I don't know when I'm on tomorrow. 3:45?
I think that's
fine. Okay. So, if anybody has any questions we can talk about, we need to go to Vespers because it's communion tonight. So we'll talk tomorrow at 3:45. Thank you.